This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur evolved from the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio, which was conceived as a project of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. Sequitur's purpose is to provide witness to extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life, not just to extreme weather events and natural disasters, and not just when they involve property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related. Fall has fallen in the Northern Hemisphere, and spring has sprung down under. A week from Monday, 24 October, is Global Oneness Day, which is the theme of today's show. I'll start by sharing some excerpts from Be Peace, my signature Expressions of Peace TV editorial effort, to highlight some of the content from an ongoing conversation with a colleague of more recent acquaintance who has been on my radar from a distance for several years. You can find the full 30-minute Be Peace show on Panina's Vimeo channel, linked under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. Most of the segments and the background concert music of Here to Here were captured by producer and mentor Stephanie Slade in 2010.
Hello, my name is Peter Melton.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome.
Happy to be on Sequitur, reaching out to those of you in the world pondering the great questions of peace and nonviolence in action, and so much more that's going on with our world right now.
You got that right. I want to pause you for a moment and hear the 2010 words of Unity of Berkeley's Reverend Patricia Keel.
I invite you, drop into your heart and feel your own connection to peace. And create that intention for yourself, for your family, for your community, for our world, every level of our world, the oceans and the rivers, the plants and the animals, and all the beings on this planet Earth and beyond, that we claim together a world of peace.
The topic of peace has been living in me forever, and living in this form I call Peter for quite some time, born a middle child and a Libra. I had that quest for balance born into me. As a teenager, I remember the Vietnam War, the peace signs coming out, and folks getting very much into this feeling of, can't we just get along? And for so long, that seemed to be what peace meant.
That's what peace meant to a lot of people. Back in 2010, under the direction of producer and videography mentor Stephanie Slade, the Unity Peace Film Project launched a project called The Soapbox. People were invited to step up on a podium that looked like a giant box of laundry soap powder and talk for a minute or two about what peace means to them. And Expressions of Peace was born. Here's transition activist Floyd Earl Smith quoting Global Peace Quilt Project founder Barbara Dexter's tagline.
Expressions of peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart.
And here, for example, is singer-songwriter Ash Ruiz of Here to Here speaking about peace through music and the relationship between inner peace and global oneness.
Pretty much all of our songs are about peace. Recognizing that the most effective way to support a peaceful planet is to be the peace you wish to see in the world. If we are appearing in your consciousness, it truly is to simply say yes to what you have discovered about peace. And clearer we can see that for the war to end in an outside world, The war stops in your own mind. And each time we stop or meditate or do something we enjoy, we get a deeper taste of this that doesn't change.
What about you, Peter?
In 1994, I went to the 25-year anniversary of Woodstock, and it was at that point that the feeling of peace and the two-finger peace symbol in particular just rubbed me so raw as to this feeling like it didn't mean anything, that whatever we've been trying to do with peace just wasn't working. There's very little to show in the real world that peace is happening the way that I think we intend it to mean. A smooth existence of collaboration with each other, with the planet, with other species. So I had this yearning that there has to be something more than this two-finger peace sign. There has to be something more than this word peace that seems so washed away. And that began what is now a 23-year journey to create some new energy around peace.
And so you invented a new peace sign, right? It was in the context of your YouTube videos about what I call the Peace Together sign that I first encountered your work as a peace activist.
Originally, the question was, what's bigger than two? And I thought three. And my first peace sign idea was three fingers and the word trees. But that slipped away when George Bush used the three fingers to represent his W. And I said, okay, so there's something more here. What that has translated into me now is three is not more than two. Then what's more than two? And I had one of those epiphany moments where, of course, three is not more than two. What's more than two is one, is the idea that we're all connected.
That's brilliant. Just don't tell the mathematics police.
At this time, I had already been knee-deep into a long spiritual quest, which had a very strong component of oneness, of this remembering that we're actually all connected. And this idea that we're separate is what has led to many, if not all, challenges that we have created as a species. This idea that we're separate from each other, that we're separate from our creator, that we're separate from our environment, that we're separate from our actions, that we're somehow separate from the future generations, and separate from the fact that we're creating and co-creating what those future generations and other species will have to live with. And it was through that thought process that I realized that what's beyond peace is this remembering of oneness. And so I created a peace sign that I call the oneness sign, where the two fingers, which originally stood for V for victory, if you look at the history of the two-finger peace sign, victory is no energy to create peace by, of course. But we didn't get that back then. But we have a chance to get it now. The two fingers now stand for this misthought, this illusion that we are separate from all different things, from each other, from the planet, from our actions. So the oneness sign starts with a two-finger expression that stands for, it appears that we're separate, but those two fingers come together.
And that's why I call it the peace together sign, the traditional peace sign, but then the fingers come together.
And then the hand comes toward the heart and lands in the heart, in that place where we know that we are connected. We know that we are one. We know that love is infinite and universal, and that that is the great energy of life that has birthed all of it.
Pak Vilai Sudhaswan was Unity of Berkeley's resident Buddhist, and I think she summed up what you were saying about global oneness very nicely. She was very close to death when Stephanie filmed her soapbox speech, and unfortunately there was so much ambient noise that I must refer you to the video if you want to hear her words in her own voice. She said, quote, "When we speak about peace, the first thing that comes to my mind is inner peace. According to the Dalai Lama, in order to have peace in the world, we have to have inner peace first. Inner peace, to me, means that your heart is open and vulnerable, and that you feel a feeling of oneness to every human being, because we all have the same pain and the same joy. We are not different," unquote. So for me, your oneness sign captures that sense of connection.
The oneness sign, two fingers, we appear to be separate. The fingers come together, we remember that we're one, and it lands in the heart where we know that place is. And so this chance for peace to be redefined, this chance for the remembering that we're all connected, is what I yearn for in these days when there is so much to look at with climate change and overpopulation and system breakdown and.
Now you're going to make me laugh and cry at the same time. My late father used to write and in his letters to me to reference all the rants that he knew he didn't have to spell out, couldn't spell out without stating the obvious or preaching to the choir. But your mention of climate change and system breakdown brings to mind the expression of peace by Francine Lancaster, in which she references the then-recent earthquake in Haiti, whose infrastructure has once again been demolished as we speak, this time by Hurricane Matthew, which climate system scientist Paul Beckwith assures us was greatly intensified by climate change, particularly the increase in sea surface temperature. Here's Francine.
I want everyone to be able to be tucked in by somebody that truly cares about them. And that's what's so sad when you see war, knowing that those people don't have a place to be comforted and loved and cared about. And in Haiti also, it's just like thinking that all those people who just don't have a place to be, just to be.
How are we going to create anything that looks like peace when this system we set up is clearly unraveling?
Good question.
My yearning for you to ponder to the degree you like and create conversations in your world, and if you feel called to use the oneness sign, and also to dare to ask ourselves, what does this look like as we remember that we're connected? Can we have a leap in human consciousness? Can we have humanity show up in a very humane way, in a very powerful and loving way, in what are very likely our final chapters? And that is my wish for the world, is that we can somehow come together, somehow realize that we are very connected to each other, to the planet, to the other species, to all of it. It's all one interwoven tapestry. The analogy I like to use the best is the ocean and the wave. When a wave is created, if the wave takes on current human consciousness, it believes that it's separate from everything else. And it can look at another wave and feel this judgment. Oh, you're bigger than me. You're chasing me. You're behind me. What are you doing? The human consciousness wave lives in this illusion that it's separate from the ocean and lives in this illusion that it's going to be scary when it hits the shore because it's going to be dead. You see, we've created this illusion of a temporary life on a linear timeline that we call our human life. But within that limited, temporary, finite world we call life exists the bigger picture, the bigger container in which it's all held, the ocean, the infinite sea of love that is who we are. And I think in order to have peace in these very trying times and to know and live with some sense of connection and oneness, that we must remember that we are the ocean expressing in the infinite playing field, but we're also the wave expressing and living with a finite playing field. It's an amazing paradoxical trick we are playing on ourselves, as I see it, that we have created this chance for the infinite to know the temporary, but to forget that it knows that. So we have stretched the infinite to create this illusion of a linear timeline. And we have to deal with, we are paradoxically holding the fact that we are the infinite ocean and the temporary wave at the same time. So I don't think we're living in a world where 5 years from now it's going to be anywhere near the status quo that we have. And it could be much sooner than that, that these unravelings will continue to happen and they'll be clearer and clearer. And we won't be able to avoid the fact that the way we've set this up, the way we've done modern society is not working, will not work, cannot work, with most of the foundational blocks we have put in with growth, population, and more and faster, it just doesn't work. And so we're going to see the unraveling. We're going to be involved in the unraveling. And it's going to be very tempting for the temporary human consciousness to turn to violence, to turn to fear, to turn to survival. And the images of that are not pretty.
You know, Peter, I grew up in New Orleans and weathered 18 hurricane seasons, most notably Hurricane Betsy in the mid-60s, and I was always struck by two things. One is the paradox that when survival is an issue, it brings out the best and the worst in people. We were without power long after our across-the-street neighbor got theirs back, and there was a snake pit of drop cords on their front lawn, with neighbors running their refrigerators and perhaps a fan or a light bulb from their power. Not that it was a close-knit community under normal circumstances. The people whose electricity had been restored owned a strip club in the French Quarter, and the old woman next door to them used to spy on us and would raise hell with our parents if we set so much as a toe on her property. But those were not normal circumstances, and people rose to the occasion, suspended their moralistic judgment, and treated this club owner with respect and gratitude. But the looters also rose to the occasion and were seen in the community selling their ill-gotten goods openly at bargain basement prices to people who were happy to have replacement goods for theirs that had been ruined, even though under normal circumstances they would never stoop to such depths. And the other thing that struck me, even as a young teenager, was that the media were full of stories about looters, but the generosity of my across-the-street neighbor got nary a mention. And I'm sure there were plenty of such stories to be told, but we never get to hear them. This paradox about what it means to be human has plagued me now for half a century. How can I hold it?
I live with as much human passion as I can find. I yearn for the human consciousness to climb the ladder, to somehow hold this unraveling as the miracle that it is. That the miracle that we're even here in the first place, the cosmic miracle, that how did this even happen? A fireball turns to stars that turn to stardust, that somehow water is created and mud is formed, and then there's shapes are formed and life emerges all over the planet, and we learn to feel and to live and to think and to ponder, and here we find ourselves this 14 billion year journey that we think we know.
Whoa, I am not a religious person. I was a science teacher, but I will confess to a sense of relief from your words on two counts. One is your use of the word miracle in the traditional sense of explaining the ineffable. I was also a musician, and song lyrics are for me the same as scriptures to others. I'm reminded of lyrics from Here to Here's song What If that I played two shows ago. What if miracles are too close for our eyes to see? And another one from Expressions of Peace theme music by the late Tad Toomey. Keep expecting miracles until they're commonplace. Magic is the physics in a universe of grace. And of course, there's my dear Charles Eisenstein's statement that what we need in our present predicament is a miracle, that nothing less is worth trying. So where does this leave us?
Oh my God, we're having conversations about the end. We're literally looking at the unraveling of a 14 billion year story.
Well, Derek Jensen might have something to say about that. I just finished reading his new book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. The title says it all, don't you think?
Or at least a major chapter in that, as far as we know it. And if you look at time, it's not even a major chapter. It's just a very small amount of time that life has been on Earth. And somehow we think that's the end-all, be-all of the universe. And so these misconceptions and this human-centric picture of our cosmic infinite story is what tweaks us.
That's the understatement of the year. I think it terrifies and infuriates us that life flows on within you and without you, as George Harrison so famously sang. So as a peace activist, what's the bottom line for Global Oneness Day?
In order to have a chance to have peace, and a chance to have nonviolence, and a chance to have love living in our world as we move into these next chapters, I believe will require us to remember that we are connected, that we are one with each other. We are one with our Creator. We are one with the planet. We are one with the other species. And as we watch and feel and live the unraveling, we can perhaps live it as divine humans realizing we are just one small chapter in this amazing story and live our lives from that place of knowing that we are infinite love. We are the ocean expressing. And this part of it that was this wave we call humanity or this wave we call my life or this wave we call Earth or our solar system is just one wave amidst millions of waves that happen as the infinite ocean of love continues to express itself all over the universe and multiple universes probably. And we breathe that in and we feel that knowingness inside that says, I know I'm the ocean, but I get to forget. We made sure we forgot so that we could experience this amazing paradox of being finite and infinite at the same time, of living a temporary human life while knowing we have an infinite life as the glory of love and life and energy, this the grand story of the cosmic world that we only know a piece of. So I invite you there. I invite you to breathe into that possibility that, yes, you are a wave and you are experiencing all that you're experiencing. And as we've all known, we're going to die. Every living thing gets to die. The wave gets to reach the shore. And when it does, it re-emerges back with the ocean that it always was. And in that remembering, that rejoining of the water that thought it was a wave, remembering that it's an ocean, I think we laugh. We laugh the grandest cosmic chuckle as we remember that we set this up for ourselves for the amazing experience of linear time, of finite within the infinite. And we laugh, and we laugh, and we laugh. I wish that for you. I wish that peace and nonviolence. I wish that living in the oneness of it all to move through your body and to assist the humanity in its grandest expression that it can muster in these times of unraveling. Blessings to you all. Signing out. The oneness, cleverly disguised as Peter.
Wow, Peter. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation about consequences, and I look forward to your continuing input. I'm especially grateful for your words about embracing paradox. I plan a future episode of Sequitur on that theme, and we'll return to the topic of oneness on our next show as we move into the season of the dead. As you so poignantly pointed out, we all get to die. And this is the time of the annual cycle when we speak to that aspect of our shared reality. But for now, I want to acknowledge another aspect of our oneness, the Jewish holiday of repentance and atonement known as Yom Kippur. Rabbi Michael Lerner has written an editorial for the occasion that speaks directly to our cultural habits of global separation. I've edited it for brevity and transpartisan applicability, and I encourage our listeners to check out the full text in Tikkun under the title American Politics, the U.S. Needs Repentance and Atonement, and incorporate a sharing into your personal self-care routine in this election season. Rabbi Lerner is calling for, quote, a new bottom line of love and generosity that could reshape every dimension of our economic, political, cultural, and spiritual assumptions about reality. To get there, we need a fundamental transformation of consciousness, close quote. The rabbi's new bottom line would seek an approach to foreign policy based on what he calls a global Marshall Plan, quote, so that the U.S. becomes known as the most generous and caring society in the world, not the toughest and most militarist. Unrealistic? Yeah, that's what they said to women seeking to overcome 10,000 years of patriarchy. Gays who wanted to achieve marriage equality. African Americans who wanted to abolish segregation. And the list goes on. You never know what is possible till you spend your life energies fighting for what is desirable. And in this case, the process has to start with changes of consciousness alongside and inside our political movements as well. The place to start is with repentance and atonement. One does not have to believe in God or be part of a religious or spiritual community to understand that changes to the heart require more than a spiffy op-ed. They require a fundamentally new way of approaching reality, unquote. Rabbi Lerner advocates using the Jewish tradition of Yom Kippur to bring in this humble approach. What makes the Jewish approach to repentance and atonement relevant to American politics is that it does not focus only on the actions we as individuals must repent, but rather, quote, recognizes us as part of a community for which we must take collective responsibility. Americans are so used to the extreme individualism promoted by capitalist values that we rarely think of ourselves as having responsibility for each other, but that is precisely what is needed, unquote. So an interfaith and non-faith-based coalition has developed a set of actions to repent that mention many things that you personally may never have done, but which are taking place in and through the social, economic, and cultural arrangements in our society for which we share communal responsibility. I suggest that you stage a community conversation cafe event to share and discuss these assertions. Quote, having this kind of conversation could be an important first step in creating a different way of approaching our problems that speaks more to the heart and reaches deeper into our inner being. And the discussion that it generates might be the first step in creating a different kind of culture. Unquote. You'll be surprised at how much impact this can have, even with people who normally seem shut off and unlikely to share their fears and hopes. I promise you that just preparing the script I'm about to read to you was the best therapy I can imagine for my ugly American complex, which has been an increasingly abundant source of despair, pain, and shame to me as the POTUS election approaches. Here's how I facilitate such a conversation cafe. After a brief check-in, I read an opening statement, and then I pass my copy of the numbered list of repentances and atonements around the circle, and have each person read the next one, calling the person by name and asking for the statement by number. I do not make copies of the statements available until after the group reading, so that people are paying attention to each other, and not to a piece of paper. I do not ask for volunteers to read. It takes too long, creates confusion, and puts me at the nexus of the conversation. Instead, I state that pass is always an option for anyone who does not want to read aloud for whatever reason, in any round except the check-in and check-out. I ask that silence be observed after the reading for personal integration and logistics, including optional bathroom and refreshment break. I let them know that I'll be dividing the group into triads for discussion of reactions to these ideas, suggestions for what they'd add that isn't here, what they'd want to eliminate that is here, which make most sense and which someone has difficulty with, etc. I try to be strategic about forming the groups so that they are trans-demographic in every way possible, and so that people are in groups with others relatively less known to them. After the discussion period, the large circle reconvenes, and one person from each triad is invited to share the highlights of their triad's discussion with the group. This sharing can be done popcorn style rather than in a round. The event closes with a brief checkout round in which each person is invited to express gratitude to their triad spokesperson and/or state a personal action plan based on what they've learned tonight. Here is the opening statement. We take collective responsibility for our own lives and for the activities of the community and society of which we are a part. We affirm our fundamental interdependence and interconnectedness. We have allowed others to be victims of incredible suffering and have turned our backs on others and their well-being. Today, we acknowledge that this world is co-created by all of us, and we seek to atone for all of it. While the struggle to change ourselves and our world may be long and painful, it is our struggle. No one else can do it for us. To the extent that we have failed to do all that we could to make ourselves and our community all that we ought to be, we ask each other for forgiveness, and we now commit ourselves to transformation this coming year as we seek to get back on the path to our highest possible selves. Here's a not-so-random sample of learners' more than 50 repentance and atonement statements. 1. We have been so preoccupied with ourselves that we have ignored the larger problems of the world. And we have been so directed toward outward realities that we have ignored our spiritual or ethical development. 2. In the name of the American people, we have used violent means to achieve our ends through invasions and occupations of sovereign nations, and we have failed to rebuild what we have destroyed. 3. We have failed to prosecute those in our government who enabled the torture of prisoners in American detention centers around the world and denied them fundamental human rights such as habeas corpus. 4. We have failed to demand that our elected representatives provide affordable health care for everyone, that they make the dramatic changes that are needed to save human habitat on this planet, and that they bring an end to the power of big money to shape our democratic process. 5. We have dulled our outrage at the continuation of poverty, oppression, and violence in this world, and hoarded the world's wealth, failing to share with the 2.5 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. We have turned our backs on the world's refugees and on the homeless in our own society, allowing them to be demeaned, assaulted, and persecuted. We have tolerated tribalism, chauvinism, and other forms of identity politics that lead us to think that our pain is more important than anyone else's pain. 6. We have supported forms of globalization that are destructive to nature and to the economic well-being of the powerless. We have not put our money and our time behind our highest ideals. We have been so concerned about our own personal tax benefits that we failed to oppose tax cuts that would bankrupt social services. 7. We have tolerated banking and investment policies that are destructive of our entire society and to the world community, such as allowing corporations to move their investments abroad to any place where they can find cheap labor or lax environmental laws. 8. We have allowed communal institutions, colleges and universities, government and politics, the media, and the entertainment industry to be shaped by those with the most money rather than by those with the most spiritual and ethical sensitivity. 9. We have acted as if homeland security can be achieved through military, political, diplomatic, cultural, or economic domination of the world rather than through a strategy of generosity and caring for the people of the world. 10. We have not been vigilant stewards of the planet and instead have allowed the water resources of the world to be bought up by private companies for private profit, energy companies to pollute the air and ground, and endless consumption to waste the Earth's scarce resources. 11. We have believed the myth that we live in a meritocracy and that therefore those who are less successful than us, either economically or in some other way, are actually less deserving. We have allowed military spending and tax cuts for the rich to undermine our society's capacity to take care of the poor, the powerless, the young, and the aging, both in the U.S. and around the world. 12. We have not done enough to challenge racist, sexist, and homophobic institutions and practices. In confronting issues of privilege, we have talked as though being white or being male makes a person somehow wrongly privileged, thereby ignoring the huge differences in privilege between rich white males and middle-income working people and poor people, and laying a guilt trip on white men for crimes that some men and some whites have done, but not all men or all whites. 13. We have made people who have different cultural, religious, or intellectual proclivities from our own feel that we are looking down on them and acted as though those who do not share our understanding of how to change our economic and political arrangements are either evil, dumb, deplorable, or without moral consciousness. 14. We have not reached out to those who share different worldviews to try to find that which is beautiful in them, or that which is in pain and needs to be healed. We have not responded with empathy to people whose pain has led them in reactionary directions, even as we rightly continue to oppose their concrete political actions. 15. We have failed to recognize that the pain people feel that leads them to religious or nationalist fundamentalist movements is in large part related to not feeling adequately respected or cared for, and even demeaned by others, and to the assumption they may be holding that they have failed in their lives. 16. We have acted as if our path is the only path to spiritual truth. We have missed opportunities to support in public the political, religious, spiritual, or ethical teachers who inspire us and whose teachings would help others. We have not taken the flyers or opened the emails of those who try to inform us of what is going on in the world that requires our moral attention. 17. We have been attached to our own picture of how our lives should be. We have refused to take the risks that could bring us a more fulfilling and meaningful life. We have not supported each other as we attempt to change. 18. We have failed to forgive our parents for the wrongs they committed against us when we were children. We have had too little compassion or too little respect for our parents or for our children or for our friends when they act in ways that disappoint or hurt us. 19. We have been judgmental or listened to or even spread negative stories about the personal lives of others. We have been manipulative or hurt others to protect our own egos. We have been jealous and tried to possess and control those we love. We have cooperated with self-destructive behavior in others or in ourselves. 20. We have been cynical about the possibility of building a world based on love and have doubted our ability to love and to receive love from others. We have not given our partners and friends the love and support they need to feel safe and to flourish. 21. We have insisted that everything we do have a payoff. We have not allowed ourselves to play. We have failed to recognize and celebrate with awe and wonder the beauty and grandeur of the universe that surrounds us. 22. We have focused on our shortcomings and transgressions and not our strengths and beauties. 23. We have failed to transcend ego so we could see ourselves and each other as what we really are, manifestations of the loving energy of the universe. And here's the closing statement with words added to transition to the break. For all of these transgressions of commission and omission, we ask for healing and transformation. We ask for the strength and compassion to forgive ourselves and each other. Let's take a breath together and observe a moment of silence. In a moment, I will ring the bell to start a 15 to 20 minute intermission so that we can rearrange the room for small group work. You can use this time for a bathroom or refreshment break or for reflection and integration. We ask that you observe a peaceful and respectful silence until you hear the bell again. When you hear the ending bell, please claim the seat with your name tag on it and orient yourself to the handouts you will find there. The handouts list the statements we just read together and some questions to help you structure your discussion. When your small group is seated, you can start by introducing yourselves to each other and determining which of you is willing to take notes and report back to the full circle. The themes of Global Oneness Day this year are seeing the divine in life and standing in the shoes of the other. Details of the program are at globalonenesssummit.org. Some of my favorite contemporary thought leaders will be featured, such as Barbara Marx Hubbard, Michael Bernard Beckwith, Deepak Chopra, and Steve Behrman, a.k.a. the Swami Beyond Ananda. I've got some excerpts from a recent promotion he did for Global Oneness Day that illustrate another way of looking at the upcoming POTUS election. By way of disclaimer, I'll preface his remarks by saying that they in no way represent the position of Sequitur, Expressions of Peace, or me personally.
If we really look with an open eye at the kinds of things that are going on in the world and the institutions that are falling apart and breaking down, and we're moving from what I call institutionalized insanity. The classic definition of insanity is continuing to do the same things over and over again and expect different results. And we have been living for the past several thousand years under what I would call the rule of the lowest common denominator, which is dominate or be dominated. And it's understandable that as peaceful agrarians were overrun by marauding marauders thousands of years ago, people have had to adopt protection as something necessary for survival. And so we now are living in a world where we are so overprotected that the protection in the form of the military-industrial complex, in the form of holding on to our separation to preserve ourselves, is really endangering the survival and thrival of our entire species. So as my partner in spontaneous evolution, Bruce Lipton, would say, crisis precipitates evolution. And if we look at the current crises on our planet, the chances of precipitation are about 100%. Laughter and comedy, levity helps us rise above whatever is bringing us down, seeing from a higher perspective. And when we're able to do that, we're able to really see the relationships that we do have, the connections that we do have, beyond the veil and illusion of separation. So the way I'm calling my tour Going Sane is we are recognizing that every community that we visited has a burgeoning sane asylum. That is a place where people have committed themselves to sanity. And by sanity, it's not necessarily normal. Sanity has the same vibration as health, coherence, and love. The word sanity, sane, is the same root as sanitary sanitation, through sanus, which means health. So even as the headlines around the world are about things that are falling apart, in every community that we have visited, and I would submit every community on earth, there is a sane and reverent and kind and awakening and connected community that is emerging. I know what you're thinking. I am proposing a sane world. I must be crazy. And one of the great values of humanity's team and Global Oneness Day is being able to connect these local entities with a global vision. And that's one of the ways that we turn the ideal into the real deal. You know, one of the articles I wrote a couple of weeks ago is evolution plays its trump card. And as we're noticing, the political conversation this year has been, so who are you voting against?
Hee-haw! It's Benjamin the Donkey here to talk about the upside of the Donald Trump candidacy. Who gives a shit? Doom's begun. We just want to have us some fun. There's a circus in town, and he makes the best clown, so run, motherfucker, run. There's no way of stopping the waning of life in the time that's remaining. But elections, we know, are a circus clown show, so they might as well be entertaining. With statements so clearly severe, his campaign will one day disappear. And as most people say, he won't go all the way, so enjoy him and life while they're here. Hee-haw!
Evolution playing its trump card indicates that we are now at a critical mass of the heretofore uncritical masses, recognizing that the system as it's devolved, a system of corruption and pay-to-play and only money rules and lowest common denominator, dominator-be-dominated rules, and we have the poster child for that, Donald Trump. We have what has to be called a sociopathic system. Why not have a real sociopath in charge? There's no way that you can sleep through this alarm. Fairfield, Iowa being a great example, our first stop, that's where the Maharishi International University is, where the transcendental meditators are. And it turned out that among the people that we consider close friends and cohorts, we had people who are tie-dyed in the wool Bernie supporters. We had the people who sponsored our event who were very much in favor of Hillary and were very angry at the Bernie people for raining on her parade. And then there were the other folks that we know there who are very devout Catholic and socially conservative, kind, sweet people who are probably going to vote for Donald Trump because there was nobody else representing their conservative point of view. And so what I got from that very profound visit is that in the heart, we're not separated. It's simply these dueling duality, this or that beliefs that keep us separate. And often when people are opposing one another, they're not really opposing another person. They're opposing a caricature, a straw man. And so one of my visions and something I've been working with for the past 8 years is the transpartisan movement to help us overcome the partisan trance. Not pretending that we don't have any differences. Putting those differences temporarily into the background. And into the foreground, putting our oneness, which again sounds abstract, but in reality what that means is the virtues and the values that the 90-something percent of us who are not sociopaths share in common. And if the American people, in fact, if the people of the world were able to gather around these very coherent human values that reflect the heart and soul of who we really are and who we're becoming, as Dwight Eisenhower said, when enough people in the world really want peace, our governments will have to give it to them. And so this is really where this movement is coming together, because even though all of these people were separated in the head by their beliefs, we had a heart connection, and essentially all of us want the same thing. After this election, after, you know, this very toxic and eye-opening election, as Swami would say, the truth shall upset you free. So it's very eye-opening. And after this, I'm really looking at increased conversation, cooperation, and visioning by groups of people from all sides, so that instead of being polarized left and right, we're coming from a deep center, which has to do with interdependence, our connection with the divine personally, independence, our willingness to be responsible actors on the stage of life, and interdependence, the recognition that we are all connected. And it's only by being spiritually connected, and responsible individuals that we can really cooperate effectively together. We have a deeply divided body politic. Half the population believes our elections are broken. The other half believes they're fixed. Sometimes when we're talking about oneness, it could feel to people like, well, it just means everything is okay. We're being neutral. And I think that this particular season, as I've been focusing on going sane, what would sanity do? How would sanity approach this particular election? In the toxicity of the campaign and the activation of playing on separation, actively hating and opposing other people who are not like us. And so for this election, as a political science major myself, I would say that it's very important that sanity ensure that Donald Trump's little pinky finger is nowhere near any button that could push anything. And at the same time, there is a realization that Hillary Clinton has represented the corporate state, has represented the Monsantos, the fossil fuel companies, the banks, and now it's not so much getting behind Hillary, but getting ahead of her, getting out in front of her, so that finally, we the people can lead. You know, in 2008, we thought we had political climate change. Swami would say, well, we had a new president, Barack Hussein Obama, and everybody was so happy because at last America has a president Hussein. What we're noticing, however, is that because a movement was not built underneath and behind Obama, just as Ralph Nader didn't build a movement behind his candidacy in 2000, that he's had to go it alone. The power of the Bernie Sanders campaign this year is in creating a strong movement that is only going to get bigger and only going to get more active and will be very beneficial should Hillary become president in creating a forward-moving, unifying, we the people kind of campaign that I am hoping will also include awakening libertarian, conservative, mainstream people who recognize that only by working together can we come up with ideas that are really transformational rather than falling back into ideological positions. In the absence of a coherent, connective view of the sacred that's shared, that goes beyond religion and non-religion, then human nature abhors a moral vacuum and the power of money will flow into that. Having achieved the so-called American dream, now what? What is that? What does it mean? What's the price of it? What is the price of all of the things that we have? I never really got into the wealth phase because I immediately went to teach in Washington, D.C., and I left my home and cronies in Brooklyn. I say I spent my deformative years there. For the last 25 or 30 years, I've been traveling around doing comedy because I love humor. I've been blessed with a good sense of humor and the ability to generate humor that hopefully doesn't hurt and only heals. And I've come to personally recognize the power that humor has to put people above the line so that they more easily can see the connections we have with one another. We just did a show in Roanoke, Virginia. It was a celebration of Unity Church of Roanoke's 45th anniversary. And we had 150 people in the room, full house, laughing. And one of the people brought a companion dog. So the companion dog would bark every time anybody applauded. And so we had this wonderful, every time people were applauding. And it was such a powerful field of playfulness, laughter, and love. The blessing of what I do is that I get to hear people laugh. I get to recognize that those laughing people have actually changed their brain chemistry and their body chemistry to the point where they can be of greater use to whoever they come in contact with. We've talked about how does one become an activist and what does that really mean. Anytime we are able to create a smile where we go, anytime we're able to give a link of encouragement, maybe I'm not okay, maybe you're not okay, but it's okay. One of the great things about being at live events is that that particular event has never happened before, and it's an opportunity to take whatever it is that you're given to play with. So here's an example. Lama Rangabar, who is a American-born Tibetan Buddhist, is raising funds to do something that he calls the Stupa, which is a Buddhist prayer shrine. The Stupa of the Great Awakening is what he's calling it. And we did a benefit to raise money for this project. And while preparing for that show, what came to me was it's counteracting the stupor of the greatest sleepening. So every time I have an opportunity to do a show, it gives me a chance to come up with something that's never been said before that relates to the people who are there. Another example, talk about playfulness. I think that part of what I love about what I do is that it engenders playfulness in other people, and I find other playful people. When I set out to do this East Coast tour, I got a call from these people in Brattleboro, Vermont. And as most people know, in Pamplona, Spain, there's something called the Running of the Bulls every year. Well, in Brattleboro, they do something called the Strolling of the Heifers. And the Strolling of the Heifers is a parade that they do every spring to celebrate and support local organic farmers. They invited me to do a benefit for their event. I love to see people using humor and playfulness out there. So those aren't like hilariously funny things, but in the course of doing all these things, you get to see that every show is an opportunity for something to emerge. When you're talking about that laughter, it is a unifying force. It's a field of laughter. And like loaves and fishes, you know, one person can come into a room with a joke, 300 people can leave with it, and they can take that energy and spread it around. George Carlin, in a cynical way, said that people go to comedy clubs just to release enough tension to go back to their miserable existences. So that's not what I do, not why I do what I do, and it's probably why I don't do comedy clubs very much. I go into places where people are already up to something, where they already have a sane asylum that they're cultivating, and I go in there to help them use laughter to create connection with other people and to be in that field of laughter so that instead of blowing off enough tension to go back to their miserable existences, they actually have even more energy to take on their worthy, love-filled, laughter-filled mission, whatever that might be in the world. So when I'm done with a show, I want to leave them filled with this energy of connection and a willingness to brighten the lives of other people as well. I would call it theology. It's a new system that helps us move past the limitations of religion and go to the essence of religion, which is religare, to create a connection between ourselves, other human beings, the web of life, and, of course, the oneness of everything. You know, we live in a world where we're inundated with content, and the overwhelmingness of content needs to be counterbalanced by the coherence of context. And the oneness coherence is very, very important. Along with the Global Oneness Day, one of the sponsors for my Going Sane tour is the Association for the Tree of Life, which is a faith-based organization dedicated to turning the climate change emergency into a climate change emergency, as in recognizing that through community and love, the two tools that we have for evolution, we human beings can use this climate crisis to create the greatest opportunity ever, using that currency, human kindness, to create a working model of humankind. Part of the value of Global Oneness Day, as I said the other day in a little tickler we did, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, Global Separation Day? Once a year, we celebrate separation. All the other days, we're connected and we're living from this connection. And so part of the reinforcement of participating in Global Oneness Day, even if we've heard these messages before, hearing them now with a new ear, and recognizing that this is this new truth that is coming through, and the more we reinforce that truth, the more we actually live into it and experience that manifest in our world, even as the darkness shows up to say, you sure you want to get rid of us? You sure you don't want to go back to the Middle Ages and the Inquisition and all of that stuff? Just checking. You know, and I think that part of that really means healing our inner Donald Trump, healing our inner wanting to dominate, only feeling safe if we know that we're in control. I think he's doing a tremendous service in that he is bringing all of these values that have been kept undercover. Everything that he's doing that we don't like, these are all things that have been done secretly. These are all things that the American empire is already doing. We've just put a nice face on it. And he's just saying, you know what, let's put the ugly face on it and see if you still want it. And I think that's a valuable service in helping us make a clearer choice and recognize that this is the last election where we're going to have two candidates that are so unacceptable to most people in this country. It's going to actually precipitate a transpartisan movement. It's already happening, but it's not in the news because the news likes polarizing news. We have to make the new news if we don't like the old news. You know, I started thinking about, you know, Black Lives Matter and racism and all of that. And racism in this country, I've come to see it as certain white people not wanting to really take responsibility for slavery. And so when you dehumanize people, then it makes it possible for you to do inhuman things to them without considering them human beings. And so part of what Donald Trump represents is bringing the dehumanization of people into the light, making it mainstream, inviting people to magnetize to it, taking this hatred and turned it into fuel for a political movement. You know, Republicans who have conscience and consciousness are put in cognitive dissonance because he's the only one who ostensibly is representing quote-unquote conservative values, although conservatives like Teddy Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower and Barry Goldwater would definitely flip in their crypt if they saw what Trump was up to. And I think that one of the very, very important reasons to send Trump down to defeat is to essentially say, we're not having any more of this manipulation via hatred. We're now ready to move on to have a more constructive conversation.
Thanks for listening to Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. And special thanks to Steve Behrman and the Swami Beyond Ananda, Rabbi Michael Lerner, Peter Melton, Benjamin the Donkey, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.